So, it's Matzah Yom Kippur, and it's been a week, and it was one of the longest, if not the longest, Aseres Yemei Tshuva that I ever had. I vividly remember that Rosh Hashanah, and I vividly remember the day after Rosh Hashanah, which is Tzom Gedalia. And I especially remember 1 o'clock in the morning the night after Tzom Gedalia when all hell broke loose. It's not an accident that this happened in Rosh Hashanah. Not from a mystical perspective, not in terms of how Hashem plans the world, and not because the Arabs, who call themselves Palestinians, planned this on Rosh Hashanah. That was going to be a very difficult year because the energy of that year, the beginning of that year, Rosh Hashanah, was the beginning of the Second Intifada. Shootings, bombings, stabbings. It was a horrible, horrible time. Unlike the first Intifada, when you had people throwing rocks and the occasional Molotov cocktail, this time it was a number of years after Oslo. So there were 200,000 guns that were floating around Yehuda v'Shomron, and many of them were being brought to bear. They were now able... Guys, this is not cool. If you want to be in the shiur, great. If you don't want to be in the shiur, that's fine. But like,
Sorry. Do you guys close the window?
Ah, that is cool, actually. Literally. Okay. No problem. You remind me later why halachically you're correct. Okay? It's halacha. Kol cholin bifnei atzina. Right? Okay? You're supposed to say if you're cold. So. There were 200,000 guns floating across the territories, shootings. There were actually five residents of the area of Gush Etzion that were murdered on the roads that I drive even now every day. Got very intense very quickly. Some of you may remember, we talked about this once. I got a phone call from my battalion commander at like 1 o'clock in the morning. He said, you have a Tzav Shmoneh. This is the night after Rosh Hashanah, right? And I'd never experienced that. Whenever I'd been in a combat situation, I was either in the regular army or was like part of Miluim. Here, you're being called up to it. Now, normally, when you do reserve duty, they legally have to give you 40 days notice. If you get your reserve duty mail, like, late, and it's 2 weeks for reserve duty, all you have to do is say you didn't get it, and they can't call you to Miluim. You have to have a certain amount of time. And the draft notice for reserve duty has all sorts of details, including has to tell you when you're going, where you're going, how long you're in for, and you know that you're getting out, and they can only call you for a certain number of days. However, there is the possibility in an emergency situation that they can call up troops. There's a special subcommittee in the Knesset that meets. They can sign this order. It's called a Tzav Shmoneh, right? Order number 8. And they can draft you at a moment's notice, right? And that's it. So he said, Guyasnu, we've been drafted. I'd never heard of this before. I never had this before. I wasn't around for the Yom Kippur War. So I said, well, how long are we going to be in for? So he said, I don't know. I said, well, when do we have to show up? He said, now. And it was 1 o'clock in the morning. You have a job. You know, you're planning on taking your kids to school the next morning. You haven't made their sandwiches. And all of a sudden, you got to get all your army gear together, run out of the house, and show up wherever you have to show up. By 3 o'clock in the morning, 97% of my unit was already sort of drafted. And by 4 o'clock in the morning, we were already on patrol. The shock of going from a normal evening to that was intense. The worst part of it was that our kav was opposite Beit Lechem, right? The edge of Efrat, which meant that the reserve duty that I was doing was 5-10 minutes from my house. So that meant it was a bizarre war. First of all, I didn't expect to be a war. I thought, okay, you know, they want to protect the areas. They're going to have us do patrols. Next thing you know, you're in gun battles, calling in helicopter gunships. It was crazy. But the craziest part of it was, you'd be in a gun battle in the morning down by Al-Khader, and then at night you'd get home for a few hours to like tuck your kids to sleep and do some email, and then you'd go out again and do some more war. It was crazy. Now you would think at the beginning, I thought, okay, this is great. I get to sleep at home when I want to. It turns out it was horrible, because normally when you go to reserve duty, your family doesn't really know what you're doing. And they, you know, your wife, you talk to your wife whenever, we didn't have cell phones back then, you talk to your wife, and, or maybe we did, I don't remember. You talk to your wife, And she says, how are you doing? You say, everything's fine. You can't really say everything's fine when she's been hearing the gunshots 10 minutes north, and she saw you in the middle of a pula, and then you have to call in a helicopter which is hovering over our house while it's firing missiles. So it was horrible. And The worst of it was Matzah Yom Kippur. Now, we didn't know that this is going to be, you know, a war. We didn't know this is going to last a couple years. We thought, you know, it'll be like a few days and things will calm down. And Bemet, after a few days, things seemed to calm down. And this wasn't the first time Israel had experienced this. Those of you who ever heard of the tunnel riots in 1996, it was a similar story. They opened up the Kotel tunnels. All hell broke loose. Arafat claimed we were trying to take over the Temple Mount. There were riots and everything else. And then after a week, it calmed down. It was a terrible week. There were 13 Israeli soldiers killed and whatever. But okay, it was a week. So this is Yom Kippur. Now, when we got to Yom Kippur, we were still drafted. And I didn't know what to do because I'm the Baal Musaf, right? And I'm davening for the Amud. But I've got all my gear. I got my radios and my cell phones and everything else that, you know, there's like a special kind of thing called a mirrors. It's like a phone walkie-talkie that you had in the army. I'm going to walk up to the Duchen in Shul on Yom Kippur with my phones in uniform. But there wasn't anybody else to have Musaf. Like, you can't ask somebody to switch you for Musaf on Yom Kippur. It takes practice. So we didn't know what to do. So B'mikura, one of the guys in the unit, Danny, was a sergeant in my unit. He was also in Shul. So he came over to me and said, look, I'll tell you what. You give me all your stuff. And if the radio goes off and they call you, then I'll come over. We'll have to figure out a way to switch you. And if it doesn't, you won't have to worry about listening to the radio while you're the Baal Musaf. I said, okay, great idea, right? So he took my phones and my mirrors and my walkie-talkie and whatever. And I put a kittel on literally over my army uniform, right? With my gun next to me on the floor. Bizarre. And nothing happened. That entire day, right? All the normal banter on the radio. Everybody's understood it's Yom Kippur. We're not going to talk unless we need to. Nothing happened. Not a shooting, not a someone in distress, nothing. And I figured, okay, it's over. Now, I wasn't listening to the radio. I hadn't heard the news. I figured it's over. You know, things calm down. And I'm getting excited. We're sitting down Matzah Yom Kippur. We come home. My wife made dinner. I'm literally in the middle of a bagel with cream cheese saying, like, okay, Bezrat Hashem tomorrow. Like, I'm sure, like, this week they'll let us out. All my radios go off, right? There was a shooting. We had to run out. And I didn't anticipate that my kids, I never had that before. Like, it's a habit, you know, you're trained, you grab your gear, you run out, you jump in your Jeep, and you go off to wherever you're being called. I never did that when I was sitting at the table with my children. I didn't have time to think about it. And, you know, a minute later, I'm gone, and my kids and my wife and a couple of guests are sitting there, and they don't quite know what to do. I wasn't there, so I don't know exactly how they reacted. And about 5 minutes later, like, they start to hear a shooting. And they have no idea where I am, and they don't know if I'm there, etc. It was a horrible, horrible experience. And you see in that experience that you never know. You just never know how the world can change in a moment. I remember the next night, we were up all night. It's a long story for another time. I finally managed to get back, and I came back, and I really felt bad because I had managed to talk to my wife, and she said the kids are like beside themselves. So I figured I'll come back with my Jeep. Right, and I'll give my kid a ride in the Jeep. He'll be all whatever. Don't know if that was a good idea, but whatever. The next night I get back, and I got back just in time to put Yonatan to sleep. Yonatan at the time was 7 years old, 7 years old. And I'm lying down in the bed with him, telling him a story. You know, he used to like me to tell him stories. And then, like, it's, you know, 20 minutes, I'm not sure who's putting who to sleep type of thing, whatever, but I got to go. And so he's got his arms around my neck. And I said to Yonatan, I got to go. And he won't let me go. And I said, Yonatan, I got to go. And I'm trying, and he won't let me go. And finally he looks at me. I'll never forget this. He says, Abba, taftich li shelo tamut. Promise me you won't die. How do you answer a question like that? What do you say to a seven-year-old who says that to you? To this day, I have no idea how to answer that question. I actually wrote a song a few days later because I couldn't figure out how to answer that question. How do we change the way we look at the world? You know, we take things for granted. How do we grab the moment and see it the way we're supposed to see it? And what is the way we're supposed to see it? So I'll share with you an idea. Because this week's Parsha is the thematic response to this question. Okay, Vayehi b'shalach paro et ha'am. And it was. The word Vayehi, by the way, is always a problematic word. Okay, it always signifies that something bad is coming down the pike. Not necessarily for who it's bad, but somebody's going to have a bad time. In fact, there's a Chassidus Rebbe, I forget which one it is. I think it's the Shem Yishmuel, the Sachar Chaver, but I could be wrong. who says, Al tikri vayhi, don't say vayhi, ala vay, oy vay, right? Okay? The vayhi is a word of impending tragedy, right? There are 10 famines in Tanakh, beginning with the famine of Avram, vayhi rav ba'aretz. Every time there's a famine, through the time of David HaMelech, it always starts with the word vayhi. So whenever you see the word vayhi, something bad's coming down. So vayhi b'shalach paro et ha'am, Paro sends the Jews out of Egypt. Then he changes his mind. He thinks, I'm Paro. He's in for a lot of trouble. He has no idea what he's about to do. Okay? Now there's an obvious question there. Vayehi b'shalach Paro et ha'am. What is the obvious? And it was when Paro sent the Jews out of Egypt. What's the obvious question? Obvious question. Pardon? Well, what's bad about that is he's going to follow them and he's going to lose his army and they're all going to drown. Right? That's pretty bad for him. Right? May not be bad for us, but bad for him. Yeah? Oh, what does it mean, b'shalach paro et ha'am? When Paro sent... Listen, there is no such... I have never seen a really religious newspaper. Do you know why? There are newspapers in the, you know, in the Stark world. Yated Ne'eman, right? No women's pictures allowed. I don't know, whatever makes them think they're religious newspapers. Fine. But they're not really religious newspapers. You know why? Because if you open up the newspaper, it'll say, right, that, I don't know, Rav Kanievsky says that we should open yeshivot or we shouldn't. And then it'll say, you know, President Trump is pulling troops out of Iran. What should it really say? The headline should be, Hashem has decided that President Trump is pulling troops out of Ichvesnist, right? Hashem has decided, Rav Kanievsky is going to say, like, Hashem decides everything. So what does it mean, vayhi b'shalach paro et ha'am? Right? What does it mean that Paro sent the nation? And yet, on the other hand, if you look in the Torah, it does. Moshe goes to Paro. Paro says, I won't let you go. Moshe can't go until Paro says, you can go. Finally, in the middle of the night, Paro says, I want you out of here, then they can go. Why do we need Paro to send us? This parsha is the parsha that deals with the question of whether we really have free choice. Are the decisions we make really ours? Or are they not ours? Vayhi b'shalach paro, Hashem says, I want you to know, you are going to be responsible for the things you do. It doesn't matter whether you're doing them really or I'm doing them. You're going to be responsible for what you do. Clearly, Hashem created the entire world. It was all poised for this exact moment when six cholents would meet in holy matrimony in Yeshivat Araita. That's godlike. You didn't make the cholent. Hashem made the cholent. He used you to make the cholent. But you're responsible for making the cholent. And we are. Even though it's all Hashem. How do we find that balance? By the way, so Hashem says, I want you to know Paro sent you out. Paro is going to be responsible for it. He's going to pay the consequence for it. It's his decision. You know? If you didn't get up this morning for Minyan, it must mean that Hashem decided that you weren't meant to get up for Minyan this morning. How do I know that? Because you didn't get up. That's obviously a very dangerous perspective. And yet it's true. If Hashem decides something's going to be, it's going to be. On the other hand, we're responsible. Now what's the flip side of that? If this is the parsha of the idea that we have to choose, right? We have to choose how we see things. We have to be responsible for what we do. On the other hand, if you look at the beginning of the parsha, right? What does it say? Find this. So Hashem takes them out of Egypt, okay? Ha'i b'shalach paro et ha'am. So Paro is sending them out, right? But then it says, V'lo nacham Elohim derech eretz plishtim ki karovu. Hashem does not allow them. He doesn't relent and let them go by way of the Philistines. Okay, so what's this? What's this? No, this is a map of Israel. Okay, right? This is a map of Israel. Here's the Golan, okay? Here's the Dead Sea, right? And here's Mitzrayim. Now, if you get out of Egypt, okay, and you want to get to Israel, which way do you head? North. You head north. You head up. Which way is Yam Suf from where they got out of Egypt? Anybody know? East. It's all the way over here. Why are they going this way? The Torah says, don't worry, I got you covered. I'm going to explain why we went this way. Hashem doesn't let them go up straight north, because then they will run into Derech Eretz Plishtim, the land of the Philistines. The Philistines were a warlike nation. Right, the cities that they populated along the coast, some, by the way, associate them with the Vikings. We're not going to go there right now. Right? They were a warlike tribe. wherever they came from. They settled the coastal region. They were traders, right? As in with a D. And the city of Ashkelon, that's a Philistine city. The city of Ashdod, Philistine city. City of Gat, Philistine city. All in that coastal area. They were, by the way, the ultimate nemesis of the Jewish people all the way through the time of David HaMelech. Okay? So Hashem says, if they go up that way, what's going to happen? Right? Pen Yerenem Lechama, they're going to see war. If they come up that way, the Plishtim are going to see them. And they're going to see war. Right? Pen Yinachem Ha'am Birotav Melchama V'Shav Mitzrayim. They will relent. They will see war. They'll be afraid. They're not going to want to do this. And what do? They'll go back to Egypt. So Hashem says, I don't want them to go back to Egypt, so I'm not taking them that way. So then who's choosing how the world unfolds? Paro or God? Seems to be a direct conflict here. Who's responsible for what happens? Us, right? Or HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? So if you look through this parsha, you see that this theme continuously repeats itself. I'll give you a couple of examples. One of the major stories, which occupies a lot of psukim in this parsha, is the man. Now, why did Hashem give us man? Right? Hineni mamtir lachem lechem min hashamayim. I am going to rain down bread from the heavens. Why am I doing this? The pasuk says, leman anasenu, so that I can test the Jewish people. Hayelech b'torati imlo. Will they follow my Torah? So that's a crazy kind of test. Especially if you buy into the midrashic understanding of man. I'm going to test you. I'm going to see if you guys are serious. I'm going to rain bread from the heavens. Let's see if you go outside and pick it up. Really? That's a test? You know, we're going to test the Bachar Midaraita. Let's see if they're serious. Are they going to show up to eat cholent? That's a test? What kind of nutcase does it? There's even a vegetarian cholent. Like for the few nebuchs, there's a vegetarian cholent, Baruch Hashem. Right? The Guttenmacher Rebbe came through. Right? Okay. So that's not a test. The Medrash says, what unique phenomenon about the man does the Medrash share with us? That it what?
It only lasted one day.
It's not that it lasted one day, it's you could only pick it for one day. Right? You're going to take it for one day. What else about the man do we know? It could taste like anything you want. That's midrashic. Right? Tastes like whatever you want. Okay? Can you imagine? You're about to eat the bread. Say, I want a cheeseburger. Ooh, it's a stark question. Can you have a cheeseburger? Anybody know the halachic answer?
Yes.
Absolutely. It's not actual milk and meat, right? Let's say you want the cholent. But you want the cholent right after you had another roll that tastes like milk. Not a problem. It's man. You could eat anything you want. I'm going to test you to see if you're going to do this, if you're going to eat the man. That's ridiculous. And what does that mean? So the Rambam in the Morning of Uchim, right, there are different answers. One day it says, you know, that there were halachos. Rashi says this. Rashi says there were special halachot, right, regarding the man. Let's see if I can find the pasuk where he says this. There's special halachot. Rashi says, Im yishmeru mitzvot atluyot bo, shelo yotiru imenu velo yetzu b'shabbat lukot. I'm going to give them something, but I'm going to give them halachos. They're going to have boundaries. We're going to see, can they stick with the boundaries? Can they choose not to gather it on Shabbat? Can they choose not to have any leftover for the next morning? And that's a whole deep idea, right? That the real challenge is that we want something, but we can't do everything we want. Boundaries, okay. But the Sfarna says something very simple, and the Rambam echoes this in the Morning of Uchim. He says, you know what the test was? It's no big deal to remember that you have to daven to HaKadosh Baruch Hu when the Egyptians are about to shmeis you at Yam Suf, right? But when man comes down every day, how long does it take before you forget that it's manna, right? You know, I remember as a kid, I used to think, wouldn't it be awesome if we could have manna? I got a clue for you. We all eat man every day. Every day. It comes down from heaven. It sits there in front of us. It could be anything we want. Okay? Who here, just raise your hand, who here came to Israel with a credit card? Parents gave you a credit card. Do you understand a credit card is manna? Like you go to the restaurant and it tastes like anything you want. You want to get burgers? Go get burgers. In fact, you don't even have to go to the restaurant anymore. You take this thing that's in your pocket, press a few buttons, and the next thing you know, pizza's delivered. It's mamish manna from heaven. It is. It's mamish manna from heaven. Are you going to remember when the manna comes from heaven that it comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Do we remember? It's exactly what the question was here. Am I going to remember once it comes every day, how long does it take before I stop appreciating what a gift it is? Do you remember when you first got here? First time you went on the roof? Do you remember that? First time you went on the roof. And you look at it, and you're like, oh my gosh. Right? Has the oh my gosh changed a little bit? You know? You have certain gifts this year, but you have certain challenges. Because your whole year has been the Rova. So it's easy after every day in the Rova to take for granted that you're in the Rova. But imagine if you went back in time and you ran into your great-great-grandfather. Right? Or your great-grandfather. And he's in the shtetl. You know what? He just got a Treblinka. He got out of Auschwitz. And you're talking to him. He says, so how's it going? He goes, oh man, I'm stuck in the old city every day. He'd look at you like you're out of your mind. You're living the life of manna from heaven. We don't appreciate it. So what is Laman on Asenu according to the Rambam? Right? It's how do you choose to look at the world? Do you see the world the way it's meant to be seen? Okay? And I'll give you an even better example. Take a look at the story at the end of the Parsha. Right? What's the story at the end of the Parsha? And I will leave you to sort of, you can go through the Parsha and apply what we're saying here to every single story in this Parsha. But let's look at the end of the Parsha, right? So what happens at the end of the Parsha? Vayisu kol adat b'nisomim b'bar sin l'maseyem al pi Hashem v'yechanu b'refidim. Ve'en mayim. There's no water. Vayara v'ami Moshe v'yomru tnu lanu mayim v'nishteh. So they say, give us water. We don't have water. Can you imagine? Hashem gave them man. It's not enough. They got to have water. Right? Now, on the one hand, they're right. Like, you're in the desert. You need water. If you don't have water, you're thirsty. On the other hand, if Hashem split the sea, and Hashem brought 10 plagues, and Hashem is turning, I mean, manna is coming from heaven already, because that's the previous parak. You're worried about water? Like, you're worried about water? Because Baruch will give you water. What were you worried about? It's like, I don't know, it's like coming in here and saying, Ravadi, is there going to be children? Because they're going to be children. He says to you, dude, don't worry. It's going to be chilling. At this point of the year, if Ravadi says it's going to be chilling, he's the Iron Man of a Raita. I don't know if you figured that out yet. What Ravadi says just happens. Right? He's just one step below Kosh Baruch Hu. It's unbelievable. If he says it's going to be chilling, it's going to be chilling. You don't have to doubt it. You didn't doubt it because Ravadi says it's going to be. Okay? So they're worried, is it going to be water? Okay. So Hashem says, Vayitzma Hashem Am L'mayim, Vayalan Am Al Moshe. We all know the story, right? Go before the people. It's a strange line. Take the Talmid Chacham, the elders. And your staff. Now what's he going to do? We all know this. What's he going to do? Why is he taking the staff? He's going to hit the rock, right? The same staff that you hit the... Let them remember that just like the Nile River, the god of Egypt, turns to blood, turns to death. If I say it's going to be water, it's going to be water. Hineni omed lefanecha sham al atzur bechorev. Right? And Moshe says, I'm going to stand on a rock in Chorev. Why is it important that he's standing on a rock? And of course, we know what happens. Water comes. Now, you and I know you can't hit a rock. Water can't come from a rock. Because when I look at a rock is anything but water. And the water's not a rock. But Hashem says, all depends how you look at the world. All depends how you look at the world. If you choose to see water from the rock, there'll be water from the rock. Right? So now this is interesting. The Jewish people have a choice here. Because water's going to come from the rock. But the question is, where does the water come from? Does it come because Moshe hits the rock? Or does it come because Hashem says, you'll have water? So there's a little detail here that people miss. Moshe stands and hits the rock in which place? In Chorev. Where is Chorev? Chorev is Har Sinai. If you go back to the story of the Sneh, right? What does it say by the burning bush? It says, Vayavo el Har Elohim Choreva, beginning of Perek Gimel. Moshe comes to the mountain of God, right? By Chorev. Chorev is associated with Har Sinai. That same Har Elohim, the only other place in the Torah that phrase is used, is by Har Sinai. So Chorev and Har Elohim, same place. And the Mefarshim say, Moshe goes to Chorev. And Bemet, Rifidim, happens right before Parshat Yitro, happens before Har Sinai. Why does Moshe have to go to Chorev? They're in Rifidim. They have no water in Rifidim. So he goes to Chorev to bring them water. And the Medrash says, you know, the river flows from Chorev and they have to see it coming, right? Because the Jewish people need to understand that water doesn't come from Moshe. Water doesn't come because you hit rocks. Water comes from Chorev. So why does Hashem have Moshe hit the rock? Because the Jewish people need to learn that they have to choose to see a different world. If we don't have the ability to choose how to see the world, right? If we're standing at Har Sinai and the experience is so overwhelming that we have no choice, then it's kafaleim hakagid. It's like the mountains over us like a barrel of wine, like we have no choice. Right? Parshat B'Shalach is about learning to see the world as in our hands. How we choose to see the world is the world that we live in, right? And that's why the Parsha ends, interestingly enough, right? Vayiven Moshe Mizbeach, sorry. Vayom Hashem Moshe Ktov Etzikaron Basefer, Ki Machoim Chet Zechor Amalek, I'm going to destroy Amalek, right? Mitachat Hashamayim. Milchama LaHashem BeAmalek. Hashem will destroy Amalek. Well, if Hashem is going to destroy Amalek, why isn't Amalek destroyed now? By the way, if you look in Parshat Dvarim, at the end of Parshat Kitetze, which is where Hashem reminds the second generation, right before they go into Eretz Yisrael, about the war on Amalek, what does it say there? Right? It says, Zachor et asher asal lecha Amalek baderech v'tzeitchem b'mitzrayim, asher korcha baderech. Now, what does that mean? The Amalekites that korcha baderech. Anybody know what that means? Kuf resh kaf. Korcha. So there are two possibilities, yeah?
Attacked.
Nope, doesn't mean attacked.
Like they like forced us?
Nope, doesn't mean forced us.
Like occurred or happened?
Okay, so one opinion is it's mikre. Like vayikra. It's something that just happened, right? In other words, they just happened to cross you. So that's a crazy way to look. What do you mean they just happened to cross you? Right? What's the other way? The other way of understanding is asher kocha, from the word kav, they cooled you down. You were so on fire, you were so enthusiastic, you just, the sea just split, miracles left and right, and then Amalek comes along and attacks you, and all of a sudden, it's not clear. What's the gematria of Amalek? Safek. Same, right? They introduce doubt to the world. Do we see Amalek as part of Hashem's plan? In which case, we don't have to worry, because it's part of Hashem's plan. Or do we see Amalek as just a coincidence? Right? We have that doubt. And we get to choose how we see the world. By the way, that verse, Asher Korcha Baderech, does not appear at the end of Vashalach. Why doesn't Hashem destroy Amalek there? Because Amalek exists so that we can have doubt. What is the value of doubt?
Choosing to make
decisions.
When you have doubt, you have to make a decision. Now, it's true that in reality, Hashem makes all the decisions. But the fact that I don't see that so clearly allows me to feel that I'm making decisions. What does the Gemara say? Hakol bidei shamayim chutz miyarat shamayim. The only, we've spoken about this before, the only real choice that you have in this world is how you choose to see the world. If you see a world where Hashem is standing at Sinai, then you'll be constantly in the presence of Hashem. If you see a world in which Amalek happens across your path, then you'll live in the world of Amalek. How does Amalek come along in Parshat B'Shalach? Right? They complain about the water. They're struggling. Where is Hashem? Hayesh Hashem b'kibenu imayim. Is God really here? If the water could be bitter, is God really here? What's the next verse, albeit with a Parsha break? Vayavo Amalek. So the rabbis say, Hayesh Hashem b'kibenu imayim. Is God really in our midst? Vayavo Amalek. That's when Amalek comes. Doubt is what allows Amalek in the door. Conviction is what pushes Amalek out the door. It's true that Hashem will destroy Amalek. He's not destroying Amalek now, because we first need to destroy Amalek. Not because Hashem can't, because the value of our position in this world is that we choose to see a destroyed Amalek. Now, Amalek represents a lot of things. Amalek represents forces that are arrayed against us, you know? I mean, you think about it, it would be easy to get really scared about what's going on in Iran. I mean, they're now, you know, producing uranium at 20%. Aviv Kochavi, the chief of staff of the Israeli army, says that, you know, if we enter this Iran deal and Biden might do it, you know, so then it could be that the breakout goes to like 2 or 3 weeks. Do we have bunker busters? Will we be able to destroy Iran? That's pretty scary. You know, maybe we should all get on a plane and get out of here. Right? Or, hard for me to imagine that after 2,000 years of dreaming, Hashem brought us all back here to be destroyed by Iran. You want to do the best thing to protect us against Iran? Learn well. Do chesed. Don't speak lashon hara. Live the dream. Live up to the responsibility of what a gift this man that we've been given is. And Iran won't be able to touch us. That's what Hashem tells us. This parsha of B'shalach Paro, it starts that Paro sends us out. It ends Milchama Lashem Ba'amalek. The transition from seeing Paro as deciding to let us go and recognize that Hashem does battle with Amalek, that's why the Jewish people have to see Moshe's hands raise and down and realize this is not a natural war. Why are the Jewish people looking up on the mountain to see Moshe's hands raise so that they can be victorious against Amalek? Because this parsha allows us to change the way we look at the world, to change the way we behave the world. It's all about perspective. And I'll just finish this off with one last story. I read this amazing story. Little boy Thomas comes home from school and he tells his mother, who's always so happy to see him when he gets home, I believe he was 8 or 9, but I could be wrong, tells his mother, this is in Port Huron in New York, New York State, in 1895, 1890, thereabouts, tells his mother that his teacher sent a letter home for her. So she gives him a kiss and a hug, and she takes the letter and she opens it up. And it looks to him like maybe she has a tear in her eye. There's something about the letter. And she turns away from him, and she's looking out the window and holding the letter, and she turns back. She's got this huge smile, and she comes over and she gives him a kiss, and she gives him a hug. And then she says, "Would you like to know what the teacher said?" He says, "Yeah." So he reads her the letter. The letter says, "Your son is a genius. And our small school is no longer capable of teaching him. He's an incredible young man. We recommend that you bring tutors to hire him because he has enormous potential." And she gives him a kiss. And from that day, she begins homeschooling him. Okay? Some 28 years later, his mother passes away. And he finds a box full of letters. And he's going through them. It's his mother's letters. And he suddenly sees that letter that he remembers. She saved the letter. So he pulls out the letter. Now he can read. So he pulls out the letter to read it. And he reads the following letter. "Dear Mrs. Edison, your son is clearly mentally challenged. He's incapable of being in school. And we don't think it's good for the other children to be around him. So we're asking you to keep him at home. And perhaps you can find ways to occupy him." That's the letter. He never knew that that's what it said. He thought he was a genius. And his mother homeschooled him for over 20 years. And that's why he becomes Thomas Alva Edison, who is the undisputed greatest genius of an entire century. We are sitting in a room full of light because Thomas Alva Edison didn't know he was mentally challenged. He thought he was a genius. How you look at the world, how you choose to communicate that, whether you tell the Kala that her dress is horrible, like Beit Shammai, or you imagine that it cannot be that a Kala isn't beautiful, right? We had 6 different children. I want to tell you the emes. Do you know why I wasn't one of the judges? Because I cannot imagine that Talmidim and Araita make a cholent and it would be anything but 100. How could you have a cholent that isn't amazing? And I tasted 4 of the cholents, Baruch Hashem. I couldn't have a 5th cholent. Biachila Gasa was already Asur Midoraisa, right? Midrabanan. They're all amazing. With naknikiyot, without naknikiyot, with meat, without meat. They're all amazing. You're all amazing. This is all amazing. Right? I don't know what's around the corner. On the one hand, there's over 1 million people in this country that have been vaccinated. They suggest within 3 weeks, meet 2 million people. It's unbelievable, right? We have 70 guys in yeshiva, in a few weeks, there'll only be five guys. And I'm guessing that by the end of next week, we'll be able to say that by the end of February, everybody will be double vaccinated, Yishtabach Shemo. I have no idea what that means. And it doesn't even matter. It doesn't matter. How do we look at this year? Do we look at this year, we didn't get to have all the Tehillim, and we didn't get to have all these out Shabbases, and we're missing all this and that, and we can't go to town, and we can't see a friend, like it's, you know? Or, we're going to finish Rambam Hilchoteh for the first time by Purim, Pesach. I've never had that happen before, because we had no Ben Azmani. We learned all through Sukkot. And we learned the week after Sukkot. And we learned in between Yom Kippur and Sukkot. We did so much learning. We're ahead of the game. You know? I want to tell you something. The energy that you have, the camaraderie that you succeed in developing, with all these barriers and plastics and everything else, is remarkable. And I think part of that is because you're going through something together that's not a simple thing. It's only a question of how you look at it. So obviously we hope Ezrat Hashem will pull the walls down. And we hope, and look, it could be that this whole year was designed so that you wouldn't get all sorts of things, so that you would realize, of course, everybody has to stay Shanabet, right? But whatever will be, B'shalach is all about what's the world that we live in. Are we living in a world, you know, there's a Torah Tzmima that says, it quotes a Gemara, that when the Jewish people went through Yamsuf, they didn't go all together through the sea. Each Shevet had its own path. Okay, and that's a whole discussion about sort of respecting individual perspectives and that differences are good. But there's one day that says, no, every Jew had his own path. Every Jew had his own path. So I saw an interesting question. If every Jew has a path through the sea, then he has a wall. So if you have 600,000 Jews, they're walking through Yamsuf, everybody has a little path, the sea isn't split. It's just little paths. So Sfasem says, you don't understand. The sea doesn't have to split. When you really know that the sea doesn't exist, only Hashem exists, right? Then you walk through the sea, whether it's there or not. It makes no difference, right? It's all about how we choose to see the world. So Hashem should bless us all, Bezrat Hashem. We're about to enter Olam Haba. We're about to enter, you know, Me'ein Olam Haba, a little glimpse of how the world could be. We have another Shabbat in Yerushalayim, in the Old City. Get to daven overlooking Har HaBayit with each other. I hope you succeed in waking up after such amazing chillant, Baruch Hashem. Hashem should bless us all with the most amazing Shabbat until next Shabbat, which is even better, Bezrat Hashem. Shabbat Shalom.